All right. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. It's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. You know, Sandy, before we went to break, I was asking you about all the movement of people. They're not exactly refugees, are they? Ukrainian people.
Well, I think they probably are. Technically speaking, they qualify as refugees, yeah.
But they're going to be, as you stated, these are educated people for the most part.
Well, I mean, you know, the interesting thing is, and I suspect, again, this is a sign of tribalism in the world, but there was a great deal of hysteria and anger and angst about the large number of Syrian and Mideastern refugees that were coming up as the result of the problem in Syria and as they were all moving into Europe. But you aren't hearing that now, and in fact, there's sort of an open-arms reception of millions of Ukrainian refugees as they leave Ukraine and move into Europe. And I suspect part of that is the fact that Ukrainians are Europeans and look like the people they're moving to live next to, number one. Number two, the education system in Ukraine is much like the education system in Russia, which is actually a very sophisticated education system. Pretty much everyone who will be moving will be pretty well educated and trained. Now, number three, a fair number of these people are expected to return to Ukraine. So while we have 10 million who have been dislocated, it probably isn't going to net out to 10 million in the long run. And a fourth thing is that Europe has been ridden by this kind of dislocation over the last 70-year history, ever since World War II, after World War II, when the Baltic nations became part of Russia. There were a couple of million German, and they weren't recently moved to Lithuania Germans. They were people who had been historically German, like back to 1600 and 1700. And all those people were deported in a sort of a cleansing process to get rid of German speakers. And they were all moved back into Germany out of that area. And the same thing happened in Hungary. And all these countries that had their lines redrawn went through sort of an ethnic slash national cleansing.
So, Sandy, help us understand, or help me understand, the orthodoxy numbers of Jewish Ukrainians.
Oh,
and what part is that? A small percentage of
yes.
the Jewish population?
Well,
I mean the Ukrainian population?
Yes, it's a relatively small percentage of the Ukrainian population. The Jewish population
yes.
is. I mean, they are numerous, but not as a percentage of the total population, very large. Same is true with the Catholic population. Most of Ukraine is Orthodox. About 6 million of them are Catholic. And I can't give you the exact number.
Right.
My guess is that it's a million Jewish in the population.
And so how
Maybe
many?
2 million.
And so how many people were in Ukraine? 5 million? 10 million?
I mean, how many were in Ukraine that left?
Yes. No. How many were
total
population?
44 million.
44 million.
Yeah. And so these numbers are all to take a percentage of it. 6 million Catholics out of 44 million leaves 38 million. Let's just say that another 4 million of those are not Orthodox. That might be Jewish or Muslim. The rest of that country is by history at least, Orthodox.
And Russia, how many
Russian
people
Orthodox.
are in Russia?
142 million.
142 million.
So there's about 100 million more Russians than there are Ukrainians. But those 100 million more populate... You know, this country's very large.
Right.
Two-thirds of the Russian population resides in European, in what was the old denominated European Russia, which is west of the Ural Mountains. And most of those people resided in St. Petersburg and in Moscow and in several of the other cities, Rostov and some of the other cities in European Russia.
So, Sandy, the reason I'm asking these questions is because...
So 100, getting back to numbers, let's say 100 million Russians live in the proximity of Ukraine and 44 million Ukrainians.
So you almost have to understand the history of all of that to even understand what this is. The magnitude of what it is. If you don't understand the history of it, then you really don't know what's going on there.
Well, the history of it, which leads to this whole geopolitical reality situation. And, you know, I just think that the problem the Americans had is we got too big for our britches and decided that our geopolitical hegemony was the world, when in fact it wasn't. There were some powerful nations in the world, Russia being one of them. Even though their economy isn't that powerful, they have military might that makes them very powerful. And China, which has both economic power and military power, and they clearly have hegemony. And so we have to worry about how we trifle with their hegemony, part of which is Taiwan. We need to be realistic. Americans need to be realistic, and we can't have this belief that we have essentially ledger domain and power over the world.
So listen to this. Those who speak of history and offer context about the West's precipitating role in the Ukraine tragedy are not excusing Russia's criminal attack. It is a measure of such thinking and the rhetorical or intellectual no-fly zone that prominent figures such as Noam Chomsky, University of Chicago professor John Mearsheimer, and former U.S. Ambassador Chase Freeman, among others, have been demonized or slurred for raising cogent arguments and providing much needed context and history to explain the background of this war.
I might be in their camp.
Yeah.
You know, I probably come at this maybe from the same level of analysis. My view is that international affairs is unfortunately an amoral thing. And we've demonstrated that over and over again with our own international affairs and the way we've carried it out, because we've probably been far less than moral than many other countries. And it's totally pragmatic. And if it's totally pragmatic, we are beginning to exercise our muscle in ways that are really unwise from a pragmatic standpoint.
You know, in our fragile democracy, the cost of dissent is comparatively low. Why then aren't more individuals at think tanks or in academia, media, or politics challenging the orthodox U.S. political media narratives? Is it not worth asking whether sending ever more weapons to Ukrainians is the wisest course? Is it too much to ask for our questioning and dissension discussion about how best to diminish the danger of nuclear conflict? Why are nonconformists smeared for nothing? Excuse me, for noting, even bolstered with reputable facts and history, the role of nationalist far-right and, yes, neo-Nazis forces in Ukraine. Fascists or neo-Nazis is a toxic factor in many countries today, from European nations to the United States. Why is Ukraine's history too often ignored, even denied?
Well, I think a problem is that in the U.S., I went to high school, I went to higher education in a pretty renowned institution, went to graduate school. All of my education basically ignored the history of Eastern Europe. And even when I studied international affairs from the period 1900 to the present in my university, the Eastern European history was pretty much ignored. So I think one of the reasons we failed to take all that into account is that institutionally and from the standpoint of our culture, we don't know anything about that Eastern European history. We've simply assumed and projected that it has been much like the Western European history, which is incidentally altogether wrong.
All right, we've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. Got to go to a break. We'll be right back.